El diario El Guardián reportó el miércoles que un sistema de vigilancia secreto conocido como XKScore permite a la inteligencia de Estados Unidos supervisar casi todo lo que un usuario hace en Internet en tiempo real. El diario británico citó documentos secretos suministrados por el analista de inteligencia Edward Snowden y señala que el programa es el de mayor amplitud operado por la Agencia Nacional de Seguridad, NSA, de Estados Unidos. El diario dijo que la existencia de XKScore corrobora la afirmación de Snowden rechazada por Washington de que la NSA podía hacer cualquier escucha telefónica, incluso al presidente, si disponía de una dirección de su correo electrónico personal. Más detalles con María Starostina de Noticias RT.
Este miércoles fueron publicados unos nuevos datos sobre las revelaciones hechas por Edward Snowden. Esta vez se trata de un programa de inteligencia que se llama XKScore. Según se afirma, es un programa de inteligencia más amplio y más secreto. Los especialistas de la NSA, según se dice, pueden controlar cada paso de los usuarios del Internet, sean los mails, los chats o también las conversaciones en cualquier tipo de las redes sociales. Para conseguir estos datos, los especialistas del centro no necesitan ni obtener algún tipo de autorización y pueden recibir todos estos datos, toda esta información online. Mientras tanto, el mismo miércoles, la NSA decidió publicar varios documentos desclasificados sobre la recogida de los datos en diferentes países sobre varios ciudadanos por todo el mundo. Según explicaron en la Agencia de Seguridad Nacional, estas medidas fueron tomadas por el gran interés de la sociedad sobre el tema y también debido a las exigencias de los usuarios, de los ciudadanos, tanto estadounidenses como de otros países, que exigen una mayor transparencia en el trabajo de los servicios de seguridad norteamericanos. Snowden, desde el pasado 23 de junio, sigue en el aeropuerto de Moscú, en el aeropuerto Sheremetyevo, y durante este plazo, Anatoly Kucherena, su asesor legal, también se ha convertido en su portavoz ante los medios de prensa.
Creo que la aparición del artículo en el periódico The Guardian no puede afectar de ninguna manera la decisión del Servicio Migratorio de Rusia a la hora de tomar una decisión positiva sobre la concesión del asilo temporal a Snowden. La razón es que toda esta información la entregó al medio antes de llegar a la Federación de Rusia.
Entre sus últimas y recientes declaraciones está que el abogado no cree, ni él, según él afirma, en Moscú nadie cree en que en Estados Unidos a Edward Snowden le podría esperar un juicio justo.
El fiscal general de Estados Unidos asegura al ministro de Justicia de Rusia que no le aplicarán torturas ni pena de muerte. Conozco el sistema judicial norteamericano. La pena la determina el tribunal y no el fiscal general. Pero estas declaraciones las hace este último, lo que para mí es sorprendente.
Esta misma declaración, con el mismo sentido, lo hizo el padre de Edward Snowden, que recientemente habló con una cadena de televisión rusa. Durante esta conexión online, Lon Snowden, así se llama su padre, expresó la esperanza de que Edward le está viendo y le pidió fijarse en su futuro, en su seguridad, y le pidió elegir el lugar más seguro para su vida futura.
We hope you're healthy.
Esperamos que estés sano. Esperamos que estés bien. Confío en poder verte pronto. Pero más que nada, lo que quiero es que estés a salvo.
Anteriormente, el propio progenitor de Edward Snowden aseguró que le habían contactado desde el FBI y le pidieron que viajara a Moscú para convencerle a su hijo para que regresara a Estados Unidos. Sin embargo, dijo que él había rechazado esta posibilidad. Lon Snowden dijo que viajaría a Moscú en un momento oportuno de manera legal para apoyarle a su hijo. Recordemos que ya durante más de un mes Edward Snowden se encuentra en la zona de tránsito del aeropuerto Sheremetyevo. El pasado 16 de julio él solicitó oficialmente el asilo político en la Federación de Rusia y en estos momentos está esperando la respuesta del Servicio Federal de Migración.
Por otra parte, el fundador de Wikileaks, Julian Assange, aconsejó a los jóvenes hackers o piratas cibernéticos a no dejarse intimidar y no paralizar sus contribuciones al mundo. Assange intervino el miércoles en la conferencia de hackers OHM 2013, que en su último día realizó 3 conferencias simultáneas en diferentes ciudades del mundo. A través de una videoconferencia, el ciudadano australiano denunció que la NSA duplica su poder cada 4 años. El fundador de Wikileaks criticó a la empresa Google, declarando que ese gigante gasta más en cabildeo en Washington que la corporación armamentista Lockheed Martin. En Bolivia dio comienzo el encuentro antiimperialista en apoyo al presidente Evo Morales y donde también se analizará el espionaje internacional norteamericano. Ramiro García tiene los detalles.
Ya están los indígenas representantes de diferentes sectores del país y del exterior del país. Así lo relata, por ejemplo, uno de los representantes del sector campesino del departamento del Beni, al norte del país.
Este compañero ha pedido al gobierno nacional, se está haciendo pues la cumbre a nivel internacional para...
La cumbre antiimperialista ha inaugurado hoy al promediar las 10 de la mañana con la presencia del vicepresidente Álvaro García Linera. Tratarán diversos temas: soberanía política, económica y territorial, vulneración de tratados y convenios internacionales y estrategias políticas continentales en 5 mesas de trabajo. El trabajo logístico continúa desarrollándose tal cual informa el ministro Pablo Glux de Culturas en Bolivia.
Bueno, estamos ya en etapa de revisión de detalles, de implementación de la logística para un evento de estas características. Les recuerdo que además de tener una plenaria con una participación de unos 1.200 delegados a
1.200 delegados aproximadamente van a ser concentrados y el próximo 2 de agosto será la conclusión de este evento, pero el tema de salud, alimentación, alojamiento es también erogado por el gobierno nacional.
Hemos verificado también que los servicios de seguridad, de salud, de alimentación estén garantizados, al igual que los lugares de hospedaje para todos los delegados que nos visitarán.
Estos gastos económicos que desarrolla el gobierno son observados por asambleístas de la oposición. Entre tanto, los sectores cocaleros anuncian una masiva presencia para el próximo 2 de agosto.
Vamos a estar porque es importante, porque acá en Bolivia tenemos que dignificar. No podemos ser...
Son las palabras de Feliciano Mamani, alcalde municipal de Villa Tunari en el trópico de Cochabamba, quien junto a otros sectores cocaleros, campesinos, dicen que van a estar masivamente el próximo 2 de agosto. Cumbre antiimperialista inaugurado por el vicepresidente y la conclusión estará el presidente Evo Morales.
Estás escuchando el informativo Pacífica. Si deseas comunicarte con nosotros, puedes escribirnos al correo electrónico pueblossinfronteras@gmail.com.
En Perú reprueban la gestión del presidente Ollanta Humala. Ronald Espinosa reporta.
Aún hoy se sigue hablando del discurso La Nación por el 192 aniversario de la independencia del Perú, pronunciado el pasado domingo 28 de julio en el Congreso de la República por el presidente Ollanta Humala. Pero las referencias que se hacen no son precisamente porque se haya anunciado grandes cambios, sino más bien por la insuficiencia en temas realmente de interés para la población. Humala se dio un baño de flores de comienzo a fin durante los 62 minutos que duró su discurso, destacando el crecimiento económico del país, y se enfocó en hablar de la inclusión social, la que se traduce mayormente en los programas sociales, algunos como el programa alimenticio Jaliwarma, seriamente cuestionado a nivel nacional.
El país que queremos es un país próspero, donde todas las peruanas y peruanos, sin distinción, puedan disfrutar los beneficios del crecimiento de manera digna, segura y con libertad.
Analistas políticos han coincidido en señalar que hubo muchos temas ausentes o temas que se tocaron de manera muy superficial. Por ejemplo, el analista Carlos Basombrillo expresó que por lo menos 4 temas necesitaron mayor interés en el mensaje de Humala. En el tema político propiamente, el gobierno, el Congreso y el Poder Judicial afrontan un enorme descrédito en los últimos días, y el presidente, en vez de ser parte de la solución, es más bien parte del problema también. Otro tema es la economía, en la que el gobierno aparentemente solamente puso hasta ahora el piloto automático. Por otro lado, en el tema social, médicos, enfermeras, sindicatos, gremios, organizaciones, colectivos y población en general, como se vio hasta un día antes del 28 de julio, mostró su rechazo saliendo a las calles en Lima y otras ciudades del país. Como era de esperarse, Humala no dijo sobre eso más que tenían el derecho de indignarse, pero los días de movilización se envió a 5.000 policías a las calles para reprimir a los manifestantes. Finalmente, el tema de la inseguridad. Aunque Humala pintó que su gobierno hace maravillas para disminuir los índices de inseguridad, la realidad en las calles es otra. Por demás está decir que la salud, educación, seguridad alimentaria, protección medioambiental y derechos de los pueblos indígenas y comunidades campesinas estuvieron superficialmente tratados o claramente ausentes en este recuento de buenas intenciones.
En Guatemala reportan que Canadá ha aceptado juzgar a sus empresas mineras que han causado daños a la diversidad guatemalteca. Juan Carlos Chanta con los detalles.
Desde el año 2007 en Guatemala, 7 comunidades aledañas al municipio de Lestor, esto en el departamento de Izabal, fueron afectados por desalojos, violación sexual y asesinato de un líder por defender el territorio y oponerse a la compañía guatemalteca de níquel, subsidiada por una empresa canadiense. Tras demandar este tipo de delitos, la Corte Suprema de Justicia de Canadá acepta en ese país juzgar a la empresa Hodney Minerals. De acuerdo con Angélica Chuk, nos comenta sobre este proceso.
Sabemos que tenemos el acompañamiento de muchas organizaciones. Yo invito a más que nos unamos para poder buscar esa justicia.
La entrevistada indica que la población se encuentra satisfecha tras recibir el fallo a favor.
Las comunidades se sienten muy contentos, pues ha ayudado mucho también para que la empresa se detenga de toda la violencia que ellos cometen en nuestro municipio.
El objetivo es que se logre cancelar esa empresa minera de líquido en esta región.
Eso lo hemos pedido varias veces. ¿Cuántas veces hemos pedido al señor presidente para que se retiren, para que no haya conflictos? Lo que nosotros defendemos también es nuestra tierra, nuestros recursos naturales, porque la riqueza que tenemos en el Estor Izabal es muy lindo y es muy valioso. Entonces no quisiéramos que otros países se lo lleven.
La entrevistada finalizó que esperan que se logre atender sus demandas en ese tribunal y se haga justicia, pero tienen claro que el proceso judicial será largo en ese país. Juan Carlos Chanta, desde la Federación Guatemalteca de Escuelas Radiofónicas FEJER.
Hemos llegado al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica. A nombre del director del proyecto, Fernando Velázquez, se despide Norma Martínez.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
And coming up next on the stream of Free Radio Santa Cruz, it's Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. I'm Robert Norris, be with you for the next 2 hours. Special interview with Mike Rhodes coming up at 7. He's a Fresno activist. He's going to talk about the crackdown on the homeless in Fresno and the response of activists there. Stay tuned and call in if you have some information or some questions. Call in number here is 831-427-3772. That's 831-427-3772. And let's go and see where we go.
The homeless, a problem for only one reason. That president raises a question, who owns a plan? The homeless, a problem for only one reason. A president raises a question, who owns a who owns the land? Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Could it be 90 million dead Indians? Who owns the land? Could it be 6 million Jews? Who owns the land? Is there a connection? Who owns the land? To all material men?
Land by Five, one of the oldest, probably not the oldest, but certainly a theme song I've often used in the past. Good evening and welcome to Bathrobes Piers Broadsides. Be with you for 2 hours, as mentioned briefly before. Might have a guest or two. I'm going to have one by phone, and I think I'm going to have an update from the Sin Bodice protest yesterday at the town clock. Maybe the resource center, I should say, it's a kind of a combination of, it's being held in different places, a series of, I guess it's a social activist retreat that's going on. We'll see if anything like that actually happens. I don't know if my guest, it wasn't really my guest, but sort of an unexpected visitor is going to give me an update on that. We'll see. And you, of course, can always call in unexpectedly. If you are listening to me on August 1st, 2013, then you're listening to the live show. If not, you're listening to an archive or to a replay later on. Hopefully we'll be on the air again, but as I've been saying, unfortunately, endlessly at the beginning of each show, or sometimes in the middle, we do not have a transmitter site. Our transmitter is down, not because it's out of order, but because we don't have a place to put it. So if you are sympathetic and have a place for us to be, a tall tree somewhere in Santa Cruz, somewhat out of the downtown area, because I think there's a gully in that area or a kind of a lower area that is not helpful for us to be in, then we are interested in citing our transmitter there. Let us know about it. The way to do that is to go to freakradio.org, although, of course, all you streamers know that already because that's where you are, presumably on the stream of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Or you can give a call to me. I'm a Free Radio Collective person, and you can reach me at 423-HUFF, 423-HUFF, which is an abbreviation for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, which is numerically dialable as 423-4833. and let me know your suggestions, your thoughts. You can also go online to the freakradio.org web address and shoot us an email, find out more information at that site about our schedule. It's being more regularly updated now than ever, as I understand it, even as our station goes down in, I don't want to say in flames, but slowly goes, sort of suffocates through essentially lack of community awareness, because if you're not on the radio, much of the community is not aware that you're even there, and you kind of gradually disappear from sight beneath the waves. So it is important for us to get a transmitter up and the signal on again. I do continue to come in and do the show. I don't know how many other broadcasters do. Perhaps there is certainly some who do, and I'm glad they do. But we're supposed to be a radio station, not a sort of a fancy podcast. Although someday I'll have to do that and spare myself the trouble of coming in at all. Wouldn't that be nice? Perhaps. Anyway, if you want to call the station with any information, thoughts, and so forth that you want to publicize, talk on the air, you can at 831-427-3772. 427-FRSC. We're big on the acronyms, Free Radio Santa Cruz. So give a call in and we'll put you on the air. Coming up next Monday is the Palo Alto City Council meeting. And that is a key meeting for homeless people who use vehicles as their survival tools, i.e. those who have homes on wheels, those who live in their cars or vans. And, of course, we have quite a population of those folks here in Santa Cruz as well. In Santa Cruz, it is illegal, of course, to do that. In Palo Alto, it is not. Palo Alto, for those who don't know, is a community, I don't know, 10, 20, 30 miles north of San Jose. It's kind of a, what do you call it, a bedroom community of Stanford University. I probably doesn't accurately describe it. I don't really know what other industry Palo Alto has. I may try to get a Palo Alto spokesperson on the air for my longer Sunday show, which goes from 9:30 to 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and get that person to give me an on-the-spot update. I actually went up to Palo Alto a couple weeks ago, almost 2 weeks ago now, to check out activists' meeting to oppose this attempt to ban people sleeping in their vehicles. It's a nasty move by the city, essentially, to kowtow to or possibly use the complaints of NIMBY people, not in my backyard types, take back Santa Cruz type types up in Palo Alto, who want to purge their neighborhoods of poor and homeless people in their vehicles. And, you know, I'm sure there are real problems with people in vehicles that can happen. There can be illegal dumping. There can be illegal defecating and urinating. Although if people live in their vehicles, you would think there would be documentation of those problems, and the documentation is very thin, or not at all. The main problem, that they've been talking about, is that the vehicles cluster. It's hard for me to actually articulate what the main problem is. There aren't that many people who live in their vehicles, aren't that many homeless in Palo Alto, far fewer than there are here in Santa Cruz. Palo Alto is a city, I believe, around the same size as Santa Cruz. I could be wrong about that. I sometimes muddle Palo Alto and Venice and Santa Monica and cities along the coast who have homeless populations. But that it's certainly true that Santa Cruz, and this is, of course, one of the great complaints of the groups that want to run the homeless out of Santa Cruz, or at least the travelers out of Santa Cruz, or at least the bad homeless, the undeserving poor out of Santa Cruz. They claim that we have more than our share and they need to be pushed somewhere else. Of course, this often is the claim of almost any community. They don't want to deal with issues of poverty or issues that come along when you're outside, when you start self-medicating and become addicted to various drugs or alcoholic, or perhaps you're living a lifestyle that's an alternative lifestyle, which involves being very low maintenance lifestyle, and you want to be left alone, but you're not the sightliest kind of person. You're not contributing, you know, rent on the 9-to-5, and you're not working at a regular job, or if you're, you know, you're getting irregular jobs. Or maybe you're actually, you know, trying to engage in creating the street culture and relying on a community of people to support each other that does not involve traditional work. This is something that sometimes middle-class communities that are forced to work or feel they're forced to work to keep up with the Joneses, to keep up with consumer goods they want to buy, to keep paying off their rent or their housing if they happen to be stuck with a mortgage, it can become very upsetting to see folks in this other situation. They are characterized as bums. They're characterized as ne'er-do-wells. They're people who are not worthy or deserving of even the most basic human compassion, particularly when they ask you for money. I mean, my God. Or, you know, and then you hear that there are, you know, drug addicts, and there's some fights that happen. You know, this becomes what would be not good, but a standard kind of thing in a house situation or, you know, an ordinary Saturday night in a bar. You don't immediately close down the bars because there are fights there, though they probably take up an undue number of police calls and calls for service and even criminal activity of different kinds, selling of drugs, buying of drugs. I don't think that's really criminal in the sense of that should be criminal, but of course it is. But when it's you can attach the label homeless to it, it becomes a little different. You can they become a very, very apt scapegoat, and that's what's happening, I think, in a lot of communities, and Palo Alto is just one of them. I'm going to begin to play now something I played part of 2 or 3 weeks ago, which is the Palo Alto, I think it's called, it's not goods and services, I think it's policies and services, I'm not quite sure of the exact name. It's a committee that voted unanimously 3-0 to recommend this vehicle habitation ban, this sleeping in your vehicle van, this living in your vehicle ban, to the full city council, which meets on Monday in Palo Alto. And you'll hear that every speaker, except for two, I'm not going to play the whole thing because there's a lot of people speaking, oppose the ban. And the city council, or I should say this committee of the city council, ignores that and just goes right ahead and forwards it to the city council 3-0. I think one of the members may be changing her mind. She originally voted against it at a prior meeting, I understand, several years ago, and then she voted in favor of ending of this vehicle ban. Now, according to the most recent emails I'm getting, she may have changed again. But let's hear what some of the public has to say, because although we're listening to the arguments in favor of, or should we say against the ban, in favor of the right to sleep in your vehicle, provided you're not engaging in other criminal activity, you know, that sort of thing, we aren't hearing the other side right now. And anyone who wants to call in, whether they be from Take Back Santa Cruz, Take Back Palo Alto, or, I don't know, Neanderthals United, can certainly do that if they wish. And we may even get a comment from someone who may be falling asleep in the studio, even as I speak. Actually, another one of our Free Radio's prime time broadcasters who also does a show which sometimes touches on homeless issues here in Santa Cruz is nodding out here in the studio while I talk, and perhaps we can coax her to the mic if she's got some thoughts. But we'll see about that. In the meantime, let's hear Pella.
Aura of it all.
And there you are. That's actually the voice. Perhaps I should introduce you. Would you like to be introduced to the masses, or are you remaining anonymous at this point?
Oh, only when it's appropriate time.
I see. So I'll use my own judgment, and let's first hear from the Palo Alto folks. This is, again, I think we're talking last month or the month before last, and these are hearings before a city council committee on the proposed vehicle habitation ban, or we're going to rip your home out from under you unless you get the hell out of our town, sort of thing. Yes, you are hearing dead air. I'm wondering why, but I'm going to find out. I'll track this to the source if it's the last thing I do. I'm not quite sure. I see. I think
We have a sinister example of someone who has unplugged our microphone, which I don't appreciate. And I will be tracking down that criminal later.
Greetings. Hi. Thank you. My name is Alice Smith. I live at 4284 Los Palos Circle. I'm well housed and have been in the same house, except for some hiatuses, since 1965. I'm privileged to be able to live in a home. I've read the staff report and the draft ordinance and speak in opposition for the following reasons. The pilot didn't get off the ground because the city didn't do the pilot itself. Instead, the staff sought out the faith-based community and nonprofits to step up to the plate. Palo Alto funds up to $1,000 per neighborhood so we can get to know our neighbors. Surely the city staff could have funded the use of our public parking lots, with appropriate toilet facilities available to be able to run the pilot along the lines of the Santa Barbara program, New Beginnings, with all of their relevant and effective rules. And I challenge everybody to go and look at page 98 of your staff's handout. It's excellent. It outlines how you can manage a parking lot camping. Criminalizing the homeless by barring vehicles, overnight parking, and sleeping in your car is inhumane, punitive, and elitist. We need a safety net and not criminalization of vehicle habitation. Use your considerable power to get ABAG to adopt a Bay Area vehicle camping program so that every community bears its share of the problems of homelessness. For the neighbors of First Presbyterian Church, and I'll add, and Coverly, whose voices at First Presbyterian Church barred the church from its humanitarian program, I say, use your millions to help the city to solve this problem and not be a NIMBY. To the staff, your job is to serve the community as a whole and should be to find a solution which does not criminalize the behavior of those less fortunate than yourselves or myself. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Weisselberg.
And it's interesting, that kind of outspoken, but the information coming from a relatively conservative person who is, she owns her own house or has lived in her own house here and there in Palo Alto since 1955, she says, you know, suggesting perfectly reasonable solutions like the, and again, we're not talking a solution for even probably the majority of homeless people, but just at least for those in vehicles. And that is an issue that I didn't find addressed when I was in this group 2 weeks ago, and it's an important one. But it's if they can go after people in vehicles, then they can go after everybody, and they are, of course, going after everybody in every community, not all at once, not across the board, but with this gradual tightening of the knot of the net, tightening of the rope, and it's just I find it interesting that she suggests, you know, a community. A regional solution to this, which, you know, it's good to, at least some initiatives to take a regional solution. There's never been, for example, such an initiative by the Santa Cruz City Council or by the Santa Cruz Board of Supervisors. I don't know if Palo Alto has done that or not. Palo Alto has a much more active community of service providers, to use their phrase, or poverty pimps, as some might critically characterize at least some of the service providers. Who are, in other words, living off the backs of homeless people and are as much concerned with keeping their grants going as they are with, and their funding going as they are with the well-being and survival of the people that they're supposed to serve or that they are, you know, providing some kind of minimal services to. In Palo Alto, as in Santa Cruz, there is no, I don't know the exact details, my understanding is there's no real shelter opportunity for the average homeless person. And the irony here is that people in vehicles have a shelter opportunity. They have it with them. They are maintaining it themselves. They are licensing their vehicle. They are keeping it in a place where it's legally parked.
They are, in their own way, supporting themselves. And when that will be taken away from them, as has happened to many people in Santa Cruz, they will be on the streets. They will be forced to use outdoors as their place to live. The Poganip here in Santa Cruz, the parks, the back spaces of, offices and other buildings downtown, inside or outside, squatting. And I'm not an opponent of any of those kinds of emergency solutions for a place to live. But it's obviously stupid if you want to stop that kind of thing to take away people's vehicles or to make it illegal and make it more likely they're going to be facing fines, because they have to do every night what you and I do without thinking, without even worrying about it. Go to sleep, those of us who have housing of some kind. So she also talks about Cubberley and the First Presbyterian Church there. The staff for two or three years, as I understand it, my understanding is not the clearest here, but they in Palo Alto were working on, or were supposed to be working on, solutions that would involve city-funded parking lots where people could sleep overnight. We don't have that in Santa Cruz. Instead, we have an exception to the camping ban on the sleeping sections of the camping ban, which make it okay for churches to provide spaces in their parking lots if they want, but not funded by the city. And likewise, businesses in their parking lots, again, not funded by the city. If they want to do that, two vehicles through a business parking lot, three vehicles to a church parking lot. Very few that I know of do this. There are a few. There is the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program, recently started again the last year by Joel Miller and other religious leaders, boosted quite vocally by Steve Plaich, who's an activist there, and others. But it serves only 20 people a night. Santa Cruz has 1,000 to 2,000 homeless people. And the shelter that's at River Street and at 115 Coral Street, if the walk-in shelter, and there is no walk-in shelter in the summer, but the waiting lists are full, but the Paul Lee Loft has 46 spaces. There's other longer-term spaces. If you get into programs at the Page Smith Community House, the River Street Shelter, and the Rebelle Family Shelter, but the problem with those places are, you have to meet certain rather specific criteria. It doesn't apply to people who are just outside and need shelter. The object is you have to prove you're a good citizen. You meet a whole bunch of requirements, and you're going to have to meet more requirements, I'm afraid, if it's not quite clear to me what exactly the city council gave away or has been surrendering to take back Santa Cruz over the last year in its latest budget activities, where it's appropriated money to the Homeless Lack of Services Center for a security gate and for ID cards. And you might say, well, don't you want to have ID for services? I mean, don't you need that for food stamps and so forth, and so there's not fraud and so forth? And the answer is, well, if you're providing free meals for people, which are a necessity, a lot more people are getting food stamps these days because of the economy, because the banks and the 1% are hoarding the money and continuing to profiteer off of the rest of us. Merrily we roll along as the wars continue to eat up billions and billions each month abroad. I mean, I shouldn't have to say this, but it does need to be said, because it's ever-present. I wouldn't want to estimate how much the NSA spying operations are costing. Probably not as much as the murder machines abroad, because I have no idea actually what the costs are. But in any case, ID cards for food services, ID cards for other things that will require people to identify themselves and then risk not getting it if they've gotten too many sleeping tickets, or if they've gotten too many sitting on the sidewalk tickets, or if they have some criminal record from somewhere that one-third of African Americans in this country now have, or it's at some point in their lives are going to go through this new slavery prison system. They're going to find themselves reluctant to involve in that. And to me, this means more desperation outside, more cruelty against those who are outside, more stupidity in dealing with this entire issue. It's enough to make you, just Well, I don't like it. So, you're listening to my long tirade, but now let's hear some more from Palo Alto. I'm trying to link it up to what happens here, because I think it's important. There's growing pressure against food services here, too. It's happening through organized NIMBY activity from Take Back Santa Cruz, Santa Cruz Neighbors, some council members. I don't know, Cynthia Matthews is on the warpath again. She was some years ago toward Father Joel Miller. Perhaps she's learned her lesson. But I know that Renee Curry's meal, which was once on Pacific Avenue, even though she left town, the meal itself, instead of returning to Pacific Avenue when it had new management, is now in the park, San Lorenzo Park, out of the way of, not in the visible to the slew of Sunday tourists, which, we wouldn't want to show them the realities of Santa Cruz. Heavens, no. I mean, that's, it might put a crimp in the Sunday shopping spree, that sort of thing. But Palo Alto is considering a vehicle ban. Let's hear some more. I'm, by the way, considering heading for Palo Alto. I'm going to try to put out an email to folks regarding what you can do to, from a distance, if you can't get up to the city council meeting on Monday, which I think starts at 6 o'clock, if I'm not mistaken. That's what Aram James told me in an interview in our last show. You can check out that interview and hear more from the former public defender of Palo Alto. At the, if you go to the Huff website, you can download the archive at huffsantacruz.org. And the name of the show has been for two decades is Bathrobes, Pierre's Broadsides. And just click on that and go to the last show, which was on Thursday, and you'll be able to hear his perspective on this whole situation. But I'd like people in Santa Cruz to be able to respond to write letters to the paper up in Palo Alto, to the mayor, to the police chief, to downtown businesses that should be, the entire community should be opposing this kind of thing. But instead, it's being left in the hands mainly of churches, homeless activists, and some service providers, and some residents to say no. It's not time to criminalize the homeless. It's time to end the crime of persecuting them. Let's hear some more.
So perhaps I could ask, because the clapping is distracting, and you may clap for those who are for or those who are against. And in either case, if we can keep it on a fair basis and not clap or make other noises when someone has spoken.
Now, this kind of talk from the chairperson who is... I don't think she's necessarily the mayor in Palo Alto. There are 9 council members in the Palo Alto City Council, as I understand it. There are 3 of them at this meeting, hearing the various testimony on this before they rubber stamp it and send it on to the City Council for this vote on Monday that's coming up. But I heard the same kind of talk from the mayor in Monterey, and you'll hear the same thing from the mayor in Santa Cruz, seeking to shut down the audience reaction. Which, of course, is a complete violation of freedom of speech. And it also violates the right to petition, because applause is a form of petitioning the government. When you're approving of someone's speech, you applaud. You say, yeah. When you don't, you boo. No, don't like that. And that is what happens in democratic assemblies when people make their views known. That's just how it is. And the idea of everyone sort of sitting on their hands and tiptoeing through the room is a way of shutting down people's honest, strong responses to real issues, and it's not good. Now, I know this can sometimes work against folks. I know when Take Back Santa Cruz crowd came to the Santa Cruz City Council and weren't shut down, by the way, when they ranted and raved. But they had a right to rant and rave. I mean, that's part of the rights I think that they should have. But it's true, in this situation in Palo Alto, the entire room had a different opinion from the 3 council members, including the woman who was officiating over this whole thing. And therefore, naturally, she wants to shut them up. No applauding, please. We'll all pretend that we're going to be very quiet here. No. I would encourage people who do attend public meetings not to be deterred from expressing your opinions, particularly in Santa Cruz. And things will work out.
I would be appreciated. Are you Dr.
Dr. Winkleberg?
Yeah, I'm Marilyn Winkleby. Thank you.
Winkleby.
Sorry. Thanks. I'd like to echo my support of what's been said so far. I've been a professor of medicine at Stanford for the last 25 years, and I'm quite knowledgeable about homeless issues through my research and my work with the Opportunity House and various homeless shelters. Over the last couple of years in particular, I've met several people who are living in their cars at Coverly, and I'd like to just put a face on this and give you a profile of four people who recently or are currently living in their cars there. The first is a woman working full-time at Facebook as a contract worker. She has a very large dental bill she's paying. After paying for food, her dental bill, storage locker, car insurance, and the Y membership that allows her to shower, there's little left over. The second is a husband and wife. These are all local people, one of whom has a serious health problem. Their children are all attending local schools, and they're at the top of their classes academically. The third is a scientist with a long work history and impressive resume in the basic sciences. He is interviewed for numerous jobs, but his older age may be a barrier in securing a job. The last are several vets from Vietnam who have mild PTSD that's significant enough that they can only secure low-paying part-time jobs. It's my understanding that there are about 5 to 15 vehicles a night at Coverly, usually less than 10. All of these people need a place to park their cars at night. All of these people have no substance abuse problems that I've met over the last 2 years. I think that linking them to existing social services, I know social services very, very well. I know the amount of housing that's available very well in the whole region. I think that it's commendable to link people, to educate them, to train them, but putting them on a list does not guarantee that these people are going to be out of their cars and in secure, quality housing. I think that even if Coverly is closed, they will stay in the area. These people grew up in the area. They have worked in the area. Their children are in schools in the area. They're going to become possibly even more visible in the residential neighborhoods. So I would like to see a proposal that's thoughtful, that is not just incumbent on saying we're going to work with social services because those resources are not available. And so I think that any proposal needs to say realistically, if we're going to link people, the arbitrary numbers, I don't care if it gives people 30 days or 6 months, it's going to come to an end, that realistically the resources in the proposal has to be a viable solution so either people can stay in their cars or secure housing for those who are secured in their cars. Thanks very much.
Thank you for speaking.
And, you know, the same thing goes for all the people who are screaming about drug abuse in Santa Cruz and needle hysteria. I guess they're two different issues. One is, they're needles. My kids are going to step on the needles. And, you know, I can understand the fear of this. I'm afraid of needles myself, not on the street. But generally, you know, when I go to the dentist and they stick it in my mouth, I close my eyes and pretend I'm somewhere else. But how many needle puncture accidents have there actually been in Santa Cruz in the last 5 to 10 years? Well, we've heard of two via Take Back Santa Cruz, and the clean team, which has gone out and extensively attempted to find needles, and found, according to their latest figures, are like 1,400 needles in 7 months, compared with 250,000 needles turned in to the needle exchange when it was operational, when the support outreach services had a place to distribute needles on Barson Street before the city council and its cowardly, stupid, and I think dangerous move closed it down behind closed doors in January. So it's a very small percentage. And what percentage of the needles found, where are the number of needle sticks? Usually those happen, as I think I said before, those accidents tend to occur in hospitals, you know, where people are screwing up because they're doing a lot of, vaccinating or shooting people with needles for different reasons, injecting people for different purposes, and then the accidents can occur there. And then it happens that the infections usually happen, as I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, only when the blood is fresh. Usually after a while it isn't that, you know, that the panic and the hysteria about, you know, there being an HIV or a hepatitis infection is generally unjustified. Again, that's my understanding from reading. Admittedly, literature is sympathetic to needle exchange. So, I mean, I want to be completely candid here. But if anyone has opposite results, I haven't seen any. I mean, there was this big brouhaha at city council here in Santa Cruz about people, a kid who got stuck with a needle, and I think there was a second incident. But you didn't hear about that person having any health problems later. And I would imagine it would be unlikely that that wouldn't be mentioned if it hadn't happened, if it had happened. And so, therefore, you know, I think it's the political use, generation of fear, to then demonize a group of people, addicts, who are outdoors, who happen to be homeless, some of them, and many, I suppose, who, you know, there could be partiers that come to town who party and who needle it up and then leave. You know, I mean, that's, Santa Cruz is a party town. It's got a boardwalk, you know, it's got a huge stadium. Thank you, City Council, for the $4 million donation to that one, or loan, I should say. And so it's time to get realistic about it. And as for drug abuse, oh, needle exchange doesn't stop drug abuse. That should hear from Ethan Berman of KSCO. I think their claim is it stops drug infections or infectious diseases spread by blood exchange, by inappropriate blood exchange and use of dirty needles. Not that it necessarily stops drug abuse. But if you're concerned about drug abuse, as some of the people who originally came to City Council as members of the Clean Team, like TJ Magallanes, wanted to do, was you need to actually fund those services. Stop arresting people for sitting downtown on Pacific Avenue and funding security hacks to harass people at the library and around City Hall. And put that money into, if you want to, into drug abuse programs. A much better idea, of course, would be to press to end the entire drug war, medicalize it, and you've got a huge amount of money that would be released. It's currently being spent on prisons, parole officers, sheriffs, police, drug testing groups, and the entire apparatus of the bogus drug war, which has a remarkable similarity to the war on terror, as far as I can see. It all operates through phony fears and ignoring reasonable alternatives. More from Palo Alto and my comments on Santa Cruz. Your comments, too, 427-3772, if you'd like to call in.
Again, I'm going to read several cards. Greg Schaefer, Tony Campi, Andrew Wolfler, Mary Klein, and I'm sorry, once again, I think it's Henri Schupp.
Henri Schupp, sir.
Yes. Yes, and I know you know who you are, and I remember you from the last time. Thank you. So if you do the same and get close to the mic, that would be helpful. And Greg Schaefer, you're first.
I'm, as you said, Greg Schaefer. Good evening. I find flaws of both logic and fact in the draft of the ordinance itself. But rather than call your attention to those, I want to call your attention to the first lines of the executive summary, which actually make the case for not enacting the ordinance. It reads, while many of these cases have not created problems, others have resulted in nuisances or more serious disturbance to residents and businesses. Since when does a city as forward-thinking as this one consider enacting a law as overreaching as this? We already have laws to address the complaints that began this whole fiasco. If we don't have adequate laws, let's look at getting more specific adequate laws, and meanwhile address neighbors and concerns through conversation, human being to human being. The fact that parking restrictions keep coming up in this discussion, in background materials, and in the proposed ordinance itself, all clearly demonstrate that multiple issues have been conflated into one. By the way, the idea that complaint-based enforcement is somehow a gracious loophole is ludicrous. It still communicates to scores of people, what you're doing is illegal, but we're just going to look the other way, leaving people living in fear and outside the law. It shouldn't be against the law at all. We've spent 2 years debating whether or not people can sleep and live in their cars. Instead of asking why is the only place that some people have to live in this city, their car. 2 years talking about an ordinance that criminalizes many for the misdeeds of few. Criminalizing everyone who lives in their cars, quote, while many of these cases have not created problems, is ridiculous, and tonight you have the power to stop it. Abandon the ordinance. Put the focus and the resources more where it belongs, on the real concern here, poverty and homelessness. Please don't let this happen on your watch. Thank you. God bless you.
Thank you, Mr. Campy. And the next one I have is Andrew Voltberg, correct?
This is Tony Campy, who I've had on the radio before. He is a man who was tasered by police when he essentially told them that he was going to go back to his vehicle. They had no right to stop him. He wasn't stopped. He was parked. They went over and they were trying to harass him to make him leave, I think, by his account. And there was because he did not obey their authority, which they had no authority, and the charges against him were ultimately dropped because there was no basis for them. I don't know, however, that he's been able to successfully sue the city. This happened 3 or 4 years ago. But he's been a leader in, or at least a strong voice in opposing the vehicle camping ban, because he lives in his vehicle, and he also, I think, has strong principles about it as well. He sent me several graphic arguments. They're not just arguments. They're arguments that are accompanied by graphics, that is, some pictures, and it's just a way of dramatizing the kind of discriminatory legislation this is. People who want to, who live nearby, can sleep in their vehicles or have guests overnight to sleep in their vehicles. Those who don't have houses won't be able to. Things of this sort, if I understand the legislation properly. And I've just pulled it up on the Internet. I'll be talking a little bit about the specific ordinance if I can find it. In the meantime, let's hear some more from this Services Committee way back in, I think, June.
Good evening. Tony Ciampi.
Sorry.
Quite frankly, the staff, first let me say that I participated in numerous working group meetings associated with this program and this ordinance. And quite frankly, the staff report is riddled with applications and falsehoods, and too many to go into tonight, because we talked about all this during the working group meetings. You claim that you want to address all kinds of behavior, yet this ordinance doesn't address any of those behaviors. Could you please explain to me why you are enacting an ordinance that will not abate any one of the problems that you claim that it will? There's only one legitimate reason to enact a law in America, and that is to prevent one person from harming another person. Discussing this issue, you have not identified the harm that a person habitating a vehicle is causing to you. You have not identified it. You identified all kinds of other behavior, but you have not identified the actual act of living in a vehicle as causing harm to anybody. And you can't identify that harm, because there is no harm in living in your vehicle. And instead of enacting a law to prevent harm, you're actually considering enacting a law that will cause harm to people who are harming no one. So I ask you, why do you want to harm people who are harming no one? Because taking away someone's vehicle is harming them. Thank you.
And that was Tony Ciampi, or Ciampi, Ciampi actually is how he pronounced it. I've been able to find online, I'll be forwarding on the Huff email list, which if you want to get on it, go to the Huff website and let me know. HuffSantaCruz.org is the Huff website, HuffSantaCruz.org, and we'll put you on the Huff email list. The ordinance is as follows. There's a findings and declaration, And then there's the actual ordinance itself. I'll read the ordinance and then I'll read the declaration. Human habitation of vehicles prohibited. It is unlawful for any person to use, occupy, or permit the use or occupancy of any vehicle for human habitation on or in any street, park, alley, public parking lot, or other public way. The following uses are exempt from the provisions of this section. Any mobile living unit used for human habitation allowed by another provision of this code or required procedure of the city. And guests of city residents that for up to 48 consecutive hours when parked adjacent to the resident's dwelling. For purposes of this section, human habitation means the use of a vehicle for a dwelling place, including but not limited to sleeping, eating, or resting, either single or in groups, and vehicle as defined as set forth in Section 670 of the California Vehicle Code as amended, and they'll be effective 30 days after it's passed. So it's the criteria for habitation are pretty loose. They are included but not limited to sleeping, eating, or resting. So in essence, you can be criminalized for resting in a vehicle and can claim that you're habitating it. That definition is broad enough to allow the police to pick and choose who they want to regard as habitating. That's, I think, a point that's brought up by some of the speakers. At least, I think I heard them in when I played some of this in the past. The findings and declarations of the City of Palo Alto. City Council hereby updates Title 9 of the Palo Alto Municipal Code to provide for prohibition of human habitation of vehicles, to provide for the continued effective management of public property, and to provide for the continued enjoyment and accessibility of public property by all Palo Alto residents and the public at large, except, of course, for those who live in vehicles or have friends who live in vehicles or relatives who live in vehicles. Doesn't say that, of course. B, vehicle parking and storage restrictions are necessary to promote the health, safety, aesthetic appearance, and general welfare of the public and to stabilize and protect the residential character of the neighborhoods and residential districts. We don't want those unsightly vehicles. Is that the code? I mean, I'm not sure what problem is being addressed here other than the aesthetic concerns overruling the survival needs of people who live in their vehicles. C, the human habitation of vehicles causes the city to incur increased costs for policing, maintenance, sanitation, garbage removal, animal control, and other problems which may arise. I don't think they provided much in the way of stats for this. Perhaps they did. My first thought would be it's much less costly to have problems with people in vehicles taking care of their vehicles and cautiously trying to make sure they're not accosted by law officers for this or that than it is people who are then forced to sleep outside and have no place to store their stuff and have no place to go to the bathroom or to otherwise collect themselves. It is a very, I mean, it seems to me directly contradictory. It's going to produce more costs for policing, maintenance, sanitation, garbage removal, animal control, and other problems. That's my offhand response to that. I could hear arguments on the other side, but I don't think the interesting thing about this, the city council, at least the subcommittee that heard this, didn't have to hear arguments on the other side. They had, like our city council, made up its mind before they started, or so it seemed. And D, the human habitation of vehicles creates a risk to the health, safety, and welfare of those persons in the vehicles as well as the public at large. I have heard zero evidence of this. The vehicles are unhealthy places. There certainly is, it's unhealthier than the street. I don't think so. These are spurious reasons, these four declared reasons for banning the habitation in vehicles in Palo Alto. At least so it seems to me. And they're going to try to cover their tracks by talking about providing, in implementing it, they will partner with local social service providers to make sure implementation is empathic and thorough. They're going to be compassionate but cruel at the same time. Recognizing the sensitivity of this issue, a framework for a rollout plan was presented, And the summary is extensive notification, get the fuck out signs all over the place, and, you know, through media and flyers to known vehicle dwellers, personal outreach to known vehicle dwellers with our social service partners, 60 days for education outreach and transition, warnings given for 30 additional days, police response, primarily to complaints with citations issued only as needed. So, the big problem here, of course, is that this is a social service cover is a hoax. There is no shelter for people. There is no place for these vehicles to go. They are simply saying, not in our town. And not because of any specific problems in terms of health or safety that they have specified and documented. Simply, it is an aesthetic and a not in my backyard, and using arguments, they're also using the argument of the magnet effect. They're saying that we're the only city that has it, so all the people will come to us. In fact, there wasn't documentation of that happening over the last 4 or 5 years that I've seen, even though Palo Alto is one of the only cities in that area that actually doesn't directly criminalize habitating a vehicle. Which really goes to show that people don't go to Palo Alto for that reason. They go there because they have connections there. They may have job opportunities there. They may have roots there before. They may have friends and other networks there. There are different reasons than this paranoid notion that, and it's the same in Santa Cruz when you talk to people who are concerned about liberalizing the rules, making them more humane, respecting the human rights of local homeless folks, to say, well, everyone will come here. If you allow these niggers their riots, then all the blackies are going to come. You know, actually, I don't know that that argument was actually used when liberalizations were presented in southern cities, if it was ever done in that way. I mean, I think the liberalizations in southern cities happened by court fiat and by aggressive action from folks protesting. It probably happened otherwise, you know, and it would be interesting to historically compare, because I think the homeless are in a situation that is in some ways very comparable to other groups that have been discriminated against, whether we're talking about women or African Americans or Latinos or disabled people or elderly people or young people. You name it. There is a sort of a mantra that is quite familiar that is essentially based on fear and prejudice and has very little to do with real concerns about safety and health and even, you know, crowding or parking problems. I mean, you know, there can be real problems, but I don't see these issues at least fairly presented. And we see this with the public hysteria citizen task force. Mayor Bryant's little private preserve that she appointed that meets every 2 weeks with its friends, the police department, in their community room, and cooks up more and more propaganda against folks who live outside, you know, characterizing a crime wave as being it's essentially rebranding what's going on in the community as criminal. These are criminals because they're sleeping outside. These are criminals because they're drinking alcohol outside, even though alcohol is a pastime enjoyed by all kinds of people. In fact, it's a profitable business in Santa Cruz. And then there's drug use and drug abuse and this stuff, which is always a convenient thing to slap on folks who are visible outside. Whereas most of us can close the door and, you know, shoot up or toke up or drink up. People are outside and who may have much more reason to do this, in the sense that they're under a lot more pressures, both internal and external, they haven't got the protection of this. And so they become targets much more easily and much more visibly and much more comfortably for those who wish to so characterize them. And very shortly I'm going to have a call, if I'm not mistaken, from Michael Rhodes of Fresno. And Michael is an activist who has been doing this kind of thing. He's been writing for the Community Alliance newspaper. He has been supplying porta potties to homeless encampments. and washing stations and toilet paper and organizing the kind of sanitary facilities as a private individual and actually as a head of an organization that's solicited this and gotten some funding from the lawsuit that his daughter, through her documentation of the abusive theft and thieve and destroy practices by the I guess it was Caltrain and the Fresno police. They were able to secure a $2.3 million settlement back in 2007. And they're still trying now to enforce that again because police are cracking down on the Fresno camp. So we're going to hear a report on that. If you want to read more about his... He's got a very good series of graphic articles on that and really documents the history of the abuse of the homeless in Fresno and the fight back by the homeless and allies of the homeless in Fresno. You can go to Central Valley Indie Media, and that's indiebay.org, indybay.org, /Central Valley, one word, small letters, Central Valley. indiebay.org, Central Valley, which I am about to do here, even as we speak. Let's see here. Making sure that our phone lines are open in case he should be calling shortly. Hopefully he will. He's pretty good about that. Let's check it out. Let's see. Having a little problem.
She is the California State Governor.
In the studio with me, I have a another voice who's been doing some checking around herself. Any updates or comments, Coral?
There's just talk about, not about what you've been talking about, but we were discussing whether we wanted to have a conversation about what the tannery's going through. And just people that are concerned about people that live by the river, actually.
Well, why don't we talk a little bit about that? And although I will be interrupted probably by this phone call, but are you living in the tannery yourself?
I might be.
You might, or you certainly have close connections with those who do, right?
Yeah, I could be within earshot of the tannery, yeah.
Now, the tannery recently had sort of a facelift and became a so-called... What, art workspace? Is that what they have over there, or is that am I mistaking that for some other place?
They need a facelift. They need some decoration on the front of the building to make it look less like a political asylum or like a prison system for artists.
But in fact, that's what they claim it is a place for artists to live and work. Is that right?
Live and work.
But explain what are the kind of conditions and problems that people report to you from there?
Well, the management. Well, I will not mention names.
Feel free to mention names if you wish.
Have little to say about what happens outside the property. That means the out of doors. They're really concerned about what's going on inside, but outside, past the driveways, is a gray zone, supposedly owned by the city of Santa Cruz, and there's people that want to use it because there's a flower garden and there's picnic tables, and they sit out there and talk and do different activities at night, and so some of the non-residents like to also use it and make a point of using it and abusing it. So some of the residents are not happy with the fact that the lines are crossed because there are no boundaries there, and people just come in, sit down, kind of trash the place, and hit you up for stuff. And there's people that live on the riverbanks. There's some addicts. There's some, you know, campers and families. And there's no poop patrol. There's no way to remove the excrement. So we're dealing with that a lot. There are kids that live at the tannery, and so they always get to see what's happening, and sometimes firsthand, and that makes the parents feel that they have to watch their kids more. And then there's the bike riding, the racing through the back way, which is private land, but it's becoming used by the bicyclists because it continues from the bike path levee. And instead of going around in front of the tannery building, people continue on through the back near the river, and sometimes you're very close to getting run down if you're not watching what's going on. So anyway, they're just chatting about what can we do, how can we be proactive, keep these homeless away from our kids, and keep these people off the levee path so that they don't come up from under the bridge and grab you and leave their poop and leave their needles. And now that's like half of the people there. And I'm not even saying half because I haven't counted, but not everybody feels that way. Some people want to see that the sanctuary camp gets initiated, and they don't know other than seeing the video at city council, and I don't think they've talked to Brent. But they'd like to see some kind of other plan for the homeless or some encampment or some way.
So this is mainly, for those who live in the tanneries, you're saying that a large segment or a significant segment feels that the homeless community nearby is, or at least some of them, are abusing the space by taking dumps, leaving needles. This sounds like standard Take Back Santa Cruz concerns, by the way. You might have perhaps a chapter in that building. Who knows?
Well, it's because they want to clean up the river every couple months. Maybe, they find this stuff and they don't like to have to clean it up. Not the poop exactly, but the needle. So only a few people say they found them, and not really that many have found, I don't think. I've helped clean up the river, and only if we're joining up with the clean team or Save Our Shores or something, that they report they find all these needles.
But you're giving a report from the tannery. You're not suggesting that, but there's a number of ill-informed bigots who are expressing a lot of...
not a lot, just a few.
Okay.
There's
so,
a ringer.
So what about the majority of people coming out and...
Shall I answer it?
Yes, there is a ring. Thank you. Oh, we're going to have to postpone this conversation about the tannery, but don't go away. Let's turn instead to the telephone. Hi there, you're on Free Radio with Robert and Coral.
Hey, Robert, it's Mike Rose in Fresno.
Hey, Mike, meet Coral. Coral, meet Mike.
Hey, Mike.
Hi.
Hello.
So I was we're talking about those dirty, filthy homeless and their needles and their trash here in Santa Cruz. Well, that's the opinion of a few people. And you yourself are getting, I guess, probably similar complaints, or actually you're addressing those complaints through providing services to the homeless encampments, which are now, quote, targeted again, according to your most recent story on Santa Cruz, I should say Central Valley Indy Media.
That's right, Robert. The city of Fresno has announced that they're going to demolish all of the existing encampments in the downtown area. There's a bunch of encampments, and they're very large, with hundreds of people living in them. And yeah, you're right. We've been providing portable toilets and trash bins to all of the encampments, and it's been keeping it fairly clean, a lot cleaner than it was when there wasn't the services there. And but in spite of that, the Pavarello House, which is the homeless center in downtown Fresno, has complained so much that they've got the police to come out and are in the process of evicting everybody yet once again, and going to destroy their shelters. And somehow they think that's going to be better for people, that they have no place to sleep at night. It doesn't make sense to me, but that's what.
Yeah, but what about the needles and the junkies and the drug addicts and the poop? I mean, I just heard this from my colleague here that's a concern of people. Some people in one of the organizations, or I should say, the living quarters, called the Tannery, and it's the big drum being beat by the group Take Back Santa Cruz and the Clean Team, and currently seems to be the opinion of the City Council majority in Santa Cruz.
Well, it's kind of interesting. I mean, here you had the city police totally avoiding the downtown homeless encampment for probably a year. They, like, hardly would step foot on them. Occasionally a patrol car would drive through, but it was very rare. And it reminded me a lot of The Wire. I don't know if you've ever watched that series, but
no.
There was a particular episode called Amsterdam where the police, this was in Baltimore, moved everybody into one rundown zone in the downtown area. And it was just a free zone where the police didn't enter, they didn't disturb anybody if they were dealing or using drugs. And we had our own version of that here for about a year. It was a pretty interesting thing to watch.
Well, I know when we last spoke and we interviewed you about a month or two ago, you talked about how many of the camps do have serious violence and safety problems. I don't know whether it's just for the people who live in them or for people passing by, but then there's a couple or maybe one camp that does not have that kind of problem. But then I think you may have qualified what you said by suggesting that, I'm not sure if you did make this qualification, there's more safety for the people in the camps than outside the camps, even in the more violent camps. Am I properly remembering what you said?
Well, people voluntarily choose to associate with, you know, wherever they are. I mean, if they want to live in a particular camp, they stay there, and if they don't, they move on. My experience has been, by and large, that people gather together because they have some reason to be together. People look out for each other. They watch their neighbor's shelter while they're gone, if they have a job or if they've gone somewhere for the day. Whereas if you're living alone, you really don't have that kind of protection. I talked about this a bit after the last demolitions in October, November of 2011, when the city did the same thing here in Fresno and evicted everybody from all of the encampments and then continued to pursue them mercilessly. If they would ever set up a sleeping bag or a tent or anything on a sidewalk, they just wouldn't let people rest. And so what I would say about that is that there are women that were living in these encampments that would have neighbors and they would look out for each other, and there would be some safety in that. But when you chase people and they're all dispersed out into the hinterlands, and there's a woman living under a oleander bush, she's a lot more susceptible to predators than if she has neighbors that she can count on and trust. So I think the city's policy of chasing people around until they get out of sight and are in very small groups or alone is a recipe for disaster. It didn't work last time, and it won't work this time. But they seem determined to reenact this play that they did almost 2 years ago.
Do you have any evidence of this, like, statistically? I tend to agree with you, more as a matter of principle than as a matter of, established fact. I mean, do you have any evidence that rape stats, assault stats, people with a, no address, transient, rose after these encampments were dispersed?
A couple things about that. All I have is anecdotal stories from people that have had problems when they're more isolated. The other thing is that I don't think homeless people here, I don't know what it's like in Santa Cruz really, but here, if they're a victim of a rape or a theft, they're not likely to call the police to help them in some way, because they really, from my conversations with people, see the police as more of a problem than somebody that's going to come and help them.
It might be useful to, because you have had the kind of legal workers who went out and, you know, documented the theft of homeless property in the past, and you got $2.3 million out of that, or, you know, that was a lawsuit that was successful in the Kincaid
yep.
case, to document it, to interview homeless people to, you know, as to whether there has been a rise in either perceived or actual danger or violence or criminal behavior towards them, either by other homeless people, by the police, or by the citizenry, you know, after the dispersal from the camps. I mean, I'm, you know, it's kind of maybe cold-blooded to talk that way, but you and I can both say, oh, yeah, you know, look at this, kind of ridiculous because you're safer in a camp and you're not. But to show some hard stats might be helpful not just for people in Fresno, but for people in other cities considering a similar problem.
Sure. That would be interesting to know. I mean, one thing that happened is that when they took people's shelters away and people were literally sleeping on sidewalks or behind bushes and stuff, so there were several people that died as a result of that exposure. There was a woman who died just outside of the gates of the Poverello house. Another man that I saw listed on the coroner's report that had hypothermia in downtown Fresno, and I think it was in front of the library. You know, if you have a shelter that you can shelter yourself in and maybe have a candle and there's a little bit of warmth from that and the heat stays around you, then your chances of survival are greater. But if you're just sleeping on concrete and you have no tent to protect yourself from the rain or the cold, your chances of survival are less. I mean, one thing you could probably do, Robert, or I could do since I'm here, is look at the records at the county hospital where most homeless people go, community hospital, and see what it was like before and just after the evictions in 2008.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I mean, I have not just a similar prejudice, but I also, I mean, I have anecdotal documentation, too, of when we had what we call the Coral Street open-air shelter, no relation to our friend Coral
uh-huh.
here in the studio, but this was back in 1994-95, when people were allowed to put up their tents, keep them up during the day, return to them at night. It's what we call the Back 40, which is now a place at Highway 1 and Highway 9, occupied by buildings which have a sort of a more privileged clientele and a more limited clientele. But these people, no one died at this encampment, but soon after people began to die when it was dispersed by Mayor Rotkin and Vice Mayor Kennedy at the time, and with the connivance of the so-called Citizens Committee on Homeless, which sounds like our version of Poverello. You know, they wanted the homeless to be run off their property because they claimed they were going to be building what they called Page Smith Community House, but they didn't. For a year and a half, and it was just it was in violation of their agreements with the homeless people who were called Save Our Shelters. I remember I was involved in that, but there were no people. When people began to die, we then started a long protest at City Hall called the City Hall Sleepers Protest in 1996, which went on for months and months and months.
Right. Well, I'm encouraging people to move down to City Hall since they're not able to stay in the encampment once they destroy all their shelters. I think if you can get 1,000 or 2,000 people to move down to City Hall, that will get somebody's attention. And maybe some more positive outcome can result from that.
Have you tried this before when the encampments were dispersed 2 years ago?
No, it was just chaos at that time, Robert.
I mean, it sounds like the dispersal of the encampments in the midst of the Occupy movement might have given trouble to the authorities, because the Occupy movement might be sympathetic to that, to the homeless people themselves. They were here in Santa Cruz.
Yeah, it was kind of interesting. These demolitions happened last time. The first one happened on a street called Santa Fe, right next to the railroad tracks. And a lot of people from the Occupy Fresno encampment, which is at Courthouse Park, came down and helped the homeless, stood with them, and actually helped create some lines of resistance where the city physically could not enter into the encampment to destroy it. And that was kind of a high point there.
Wasn't that the one where they went around the other side and destroyed it by sneaking in the back? Yeah, I remember that.
The city and Caltrans, they were both involved in this. They have a lot of resources. They've got a lot of time. They could wait us out in a lot of ways. But what I was going to say about Occupy, though, is kind of interesting. I, in the midst of this, I got up on a platform with Patch, who was one of the leaders in that encampment, and introduced him, and he spoke about what was happening and thanking people for coming out to help them protect their homes. And afterwards, I encouraged people that if this encampment is destroyed, that everybody should move to Occupy Fresno. And right after that, I got pulled aside by people from Occupy Fresno who were outraged that I suggested that, complaining that they weren't prepared to take all these people in, and how could I have suggested that to them, not knowing if there was a place for them to stay. And I was rather surprised by that, them calling me out on that, because I thought it made perfect sense that Occupy Fresno would welcome the homeless and other people who are oppressed. But apparently that wasn't the case.
Well, I know in Portland, I was surprised to hear that it was only last week that Occupy Portland's homeless encampment, which has been parked in front of, I guess, City Hall or some other government building for 2 years, was dispersed by the Portland, I guess they call them, the Portland police. They call themselves the Something Squad or whatever. So, you know, some of the Occupy movements were in close if not collusion and support of homeless people. The homeless encampments kind of retained the Occupy brand afterward and continued it themselves.
Yeah, well, that happened here. Actually, Patch moved into Occupy Fresno right after being evicted from Santa Fe encampment and became a leader there, brought a lot of his friends into the Occupy movement. And at this point in time, Occupy still exists at Courthouse Park. In fact, I think Fresno is one of the longest-lasting, if not the longest-lasting, continuous Occupy movement that has stayed in place. And at this point in time, it's almost all homeless people that are there.
How big is it?
It's not terribly big. I mean, there might be 10 people there on a regular basis.
And is it a 24-hour occupation?
Yeah.
Wow.
And there's more homeless people that are living in the park, but I wouldn't necessarily say that they're part of Occupy, although they're probably there because of the space that the Occupy movement has allowed in demanding their right to have the encampment. And there's a large legal battle here. There was a lot of sit-ins, a lot of people got arrested, and so, yeah, it was kind of interesting how at first they were reluctant to invite them in and criticized me for encouraging homeless people to go to Occupy. And then in the end, it ends up being almost all homeless people that are there.
You know, do you think that, is Patch still there?
No, he ended up getting an apartment and going back to school. I mean, he's like 50-something years old. And ended up getting some money to go to college, and he's got an apartment, and is, you know, doing relatively well.
Which is nice, but on the other hand, one wonders, is there any continuity in the activist either leadership or structure over the last decade in the homeless movement? I know you had Al Williams, you know, you've had others who've, you know, spoken out on these issues on the show, and, you know, I imagine also in Fresno.
Sure.
But are they still active? Is there a structure which is maintained? Is experience, are people learning from these past struggles who are actually on the ground there, who are homeless?
I wish I could say that there was a lot of organizing going on that people have gained from the experience, but there's a lot of turnover. I mean, it's just, I think, inevitable that people are going to move on and find themselves in different circumstances. And Patch is one example of somebody who did that. He had some pretty good skills and was great while he was there, but some opportunity presented himself, and he took it to improve his life. I would like to make a martyr out of him, but he had other ideas. Al Williams is still out on the streets. He's still homeless. He lives in the Roding Park area, and in some ways, he's like the informal mayor of that little community out there, and people look to him for some guidance and advice. But nobody lately, that I'm aware of, has really been able to organize a movement that seeks enough political power that it can stop the city in these vicious attacks against them. It would take somebody with some extraordinary skill, I think, to be able to organize homeless people to take that kind of power in the city. It's going to be a bloody fight in about a month here when these evictions take place, because it sounds like the city is going to make a significant effort to not allow people to resettle anywhere. And it's unpredictable what people will do when their back's up against the wall and they have no other choices. So sometimes when people are desperate, they'll do desperate things. They might even organize and take over City Hall.
You work with not only the Community Alliance, but you also have Fresno Homeless Alliance online. I've seen, exchanging emails and updates and articles from the Fresno Bee, I guess it is. Has this organization grown in strength? I know there was a lot of... Let me ask you that question first. Is it an ongoing organization that, in its own way, although probably composed mostly of housed people, carries the experience of at least some of these struggles forward?
Well, the organization here is very loose, Robert. I mean, in fact, ever so often, and it happens every year or so, somebody will come through that has a lot of energy and a lot of enthusiasm, pulls all these people together around homeless issues, and they're trying to figure out some pathway to empower people and to change the outcomes that we see in Fresno and improve people's lives. And it lasts for a short period of time, 3 months, 6 months, and then it dissipates. And I've seen that emerge time after time. Sometimes there's homeless people involved in this. Sometimes it's all people who are housed that are coming from different perspectives. Maybe they're faith-based, or maybe they're coming from some place like Food Not Bombs. There are a lot of groups that have some connection with the homeless issue in Fresno, but they all are more or less in their own silos, and they're not working together. The only place I think that people get common information is like through this Fresno Homeless Advocates listserv. So people that want to sort of stay in touch are on that listserv, and they sort of keep up on what's happening through that. I don't think there's any other ongoing meetings of a regular basis. I mean, I'm sure these groups like Food Not Bombs or others get together and they talk among themselves, but as far as all the groups coming together or the groups and homeless people coming together, it doesn't happen very often.
I know at one time you were reaching out to homeless groups in different cities, in the area around Fresno. Is that still going on?
No, I'd have to say it's not. There was an effort to get people together from basically San Jose, San Francisco, Sacramento, Fresno, Merced, and we had meetings every couple months, and people have maintained contact with each other, but those meetings are no longer taking place. It would be good if they were. I think that people are just so busy dealing with whatever they're dealing with that trying to have regional coordination is maybe more than we can do.
How's the foreclosure situation and the employment situation in Fresno compare with the last few years?
It's probably hasn't changed a whole lot. There are so many foreclosed and boarded up homes everywhere on just every block, and particularly in the poor areas of town. And people, of course, live in those. Homeless people use those homes to live in when they're available. They'll break in and occupy them. And I think that happens probably more than anybody would imagine or knows about. But it's done quietly, from what I've heard. When the police do come and evict them, they want it to be very quiet. They don't want it to make a big wave. They don't want other people getting the idea that they too should take over homes. But they do. So people aren't being arrested for it, but they do get kicked out after a while if somebody, you know, a neighbor or something, calls the police and says, hey, there's people living in the house next door that's supposed to be boarded up. The police will come out and evict them eventually, but it's not a big crime. Nobody.
Is there a lot of police violence and abuse against the homeless, or is it subsided? Is it, you know, any comments on that?
Well, I think it has been escalating lately. I've had a lot of calls from people that are complaining, and I'm talking just in the last couple of days here, about incidences involving the police getting more and more aggressive. And that's one of the troubling things that I see here right now, is that there's just this escalation of aggressiveness by the police. For example, there's a guy who lives up on Herndon and a couple that live on Herndon and Blackstone, which is way up in North Fresno, which is the more affluent part of town, for those of you who might not be familiar with Fresno. And he and his girlfriend hold a sign, and they have remained pretty undisturbed for months or maybe a year or so. And just recently, in the last month or so, the police have gotten very aggressive in trying to force them to leave that area. And what this William and Lori, what William and Lori told me was that this particular officer came. They obviously had a plan when they came, because they didn't come, I should put it the other way, they came prepared. They came with a big pickup truck. They told them that they were obstructing the sidewalk and that they were trespassing. And, you know, just to try to explain what that might look like, the sidewalk at that intersection is about 10 feet wide. It's an extremely wide sidewalk, and they were taking up about a foot of it. And yet they were arrested and taken downtown. Their shopping carts, their dogs, them were put, I think they were put in a patrol car, but all their belongings were put in a pickup truck, hauled downtown. They were booked, fingerprinted, they went through whatever booking process they had, and then released in the downtown area. When this officer, Lee, released them, he told them, if I see you north of the Pavarello house, which is way on the southern part of downtown, that you should pull everything out of your pocket, put your hands behind your back, and assume that you're under arrest. And after that, we're going to take your dogs down to the pound and kill them. And you're going to be in jail for whatever. They didn't really elaborate on what he was going to arrest them for, but just that they would be arrested if they're uptown again. So he left them about 10 miles from where they live. They had to somehow get back to their corner so that they could make a little money to survive. And then after that, as if that wasn't enough, I mean, and this officer continues to come out and harass them.
This is Officer Lee you're talking about?
Yeah.
Now, what's his first name?
I don't have that with me.
It's not Robert E. by any chance.
Could be.
It sounds like Sunset Towns stuff. You ever read Sunset Towns?
Sure. That's kind of what Clovis is, which is just the next town over. They, you know, anybody that's there late in the day is chased out. There, you see no homeless people in Clovis camped out anywhere or with signs or anything because they are on them. And I don't know what they do. I actually just know they're not there, and anybody who I talk to about it, like, yeah, well, we don't go to Clovis because it sucks.
What about the ACLU and this ongoing lawsuit? You know, is a case like that of William and Lori something that they're willing to take up, or are they just not interested?
Well, let me tell you one more thing about what happened to Robert.
Go ahead.
William and Lori is last week when I went out to talk to them, they showed me a restraining order that had been issued that prevents William from being within 100 yards of that street corner. And to me, that's kind of a new approach to keeping people away from a public place. I mean, this is a sidewalk that should be public, but he cannot be there or he can be arrested. So anyway, I just wanted to share that with you. I thought that was kind of interesting. As far as the ACLU goes, I did talk to them about this, but they're not going to take that particular case on. It's just not something that they're going to do. The ACLU has actually just, they've opened an office here in Fresno, and they've just hired an attorney. They've got some staff members, two organizers that are working, and they have a staff person who is an attorney. She's going to be taking on some cases. A lot of this, what she's going to be doing, though, has to do with reproductive rights and some of the issues that are going on at some of the high schools here where they're trying to teach abstinence only. So half of her time is focused on that issue, and the other half is kind of open to whatever comes up. It could be police accountability issues. It could be homeless issues. She is going to help me on a case where the Fresno Irrigation District destroyed an encampment about 2 weeks ago, and so she said she would follow up on that one, but the William and Lori case wasn't something that she was going to be able to take on.
What's her name?
Novella. I don't have her last name on the tip of my tongue, but she has a memorable first name.
Huh. Yes, indeed. Novella. We're talking with Mike Rhodes, who's a writer and activist with, I don't know, Community Homeless Alliance. I talk to you mainly about homeless issues, but you cover a whole variety of matters. I mean, we talk about that mostly. You were one time trying to get a civilian police review auditor, to my chagrin,
you'd have to agree that police accountability is a good thing, and holding the police accountable is important.
Yeah, but I don't think an auditor has anything to do with holding the police accountable. That's the problem. I mean, it provides the illusion of accountability, and that can be worse than no accountability at all. See, that's one of the problems with that.
I totally understand that. Right. That's kind of what I argue to the people who are promoting the auditor. I'm sort of the left wing of that argument of saying I don't think that this is working, and it gives them some cover to say they're doing something. And, in fact, nothing's changing. And so I do work on...
So you do have an auditor now, though?
Yeah, we do. The guy actually lives in Salt Lake City.
Oh, that's nice. Flies on out every so often.
Whenever the mood strikes him. He issues his report. You ought to look it up on the City of Fresno website. It's just totally incomprehensible. It has, like, a number of the case number, and then it has some indication about what it was about, you know, if it was about excessive force or an officer-involved shooting, and then it has in the next, it's like a grid, and then the next line is what was the outcome, and it was either, it's almost always that they found that the police did the right thing, and some things are still under investigation.
Uh-huh.
But you never know
right.
what the case was about, because you can't tell reading the stupid report.
Yeah, that's why what you've got to do with that. We found the same thing happened even when we had a police review board here. We needed to establish an open file where other groups publicize the cases, because these boards never do. I mean, at least I generally don't. I mean, I guess Berkeley might have been an exception for a period of time 20 years ago. I don't know. Also, these boards are screwed with the Copley decision out of San Diego, which... You know, confidentializes, a la NSA kind of thing, to guard the police personnel from having any of the results of these investigations revealed to the public. It's good that they even mention whether the complaint has been sustained, unsustained, unfounded, or there's some fourth category, I think, that they have, or they used to anyway, but. Since 2006, it's gotten even worse, although I think there have been some attempts in the state legislature to change it. You also talked to me about having some concerns about your personal safety. Is that still a matter of some... was that just a momentary nightmare that you woke from, or what happened there?
Just a paranoid delusion, I'm afraid. I don't know. I mean, I get all these attacks on the Fresno Bee will write something about the homeless and people will end up attacking me about my positions on the homeless, and it just kind of the other day got to such a level I was like, what is going on with that? I mean, I somebody either has way too much time on their hands. Because they're all anonymous, right? You have these anonymous phantoms out there attacking you. Or there's some kind of paid provocateur from the right that is, just putting this stuff out as personal attacks. If they can't attack you for your positions, they attack you personally. It got so bad a while ago, Robert, that I had somebody posting on IndieBay about, my need to get a new security door on my front door. They put a map to my house on there, and they broke into the back of our house, and so I knew that they were serious. And then they started posting shit about my daughter's comings and goings that nobody has any reason to know about. It's like my daughter had been in New York studying, she was in college at the time, and so she had come back, and they, the day she came back, they identified what she was wearing and where she'd been, pretty scary shit.
And naturally the police jumped in to support you and give you witness protection or whatever.
Yeah, right. That was my first thought, is to get the police involved.
What about colleagues? I mean, I find that the most difficult thing for me is when colleagues start attacking, because either they suddenly decide you're a provocateur, or they decide you're being too critical of other organizations on the left. I'm often critical of you. You've heard me talking about the ACLU here and the other organizations that don't really name names or take action against local abuses, but are big, Trayvon Martin, woo, 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 and they'll raise that banner because it's in it, and they should. I'm not saying they shouldn't, but you don't get the attacks or criticism of the local police department and the local sheriff in a way that might change and identify real cases of abuse here in Santa Cruz. Go ahead.
My thought, the thing that I'm thinking about with that, Robert, is there's this guy, Angelo Fernandez, who got shot in the back. He was unarmed, shot in the back by the police. And so, I got an attorney to file a lawsuit on his behalf. And then the police arrested him again, arrested his father, arrested his brothers, just, you know, it was like a full-out attack against his family. And, you know, then, so they're in a position of, if you're trying to be proactive and you're filing a lawsuit against excessive force and the police having shot this guy when they shouldn't have, then the police just attacked you more. So the attorney who originally took it on dropped the case because Angelo had gotten arrested again, and it was, she thought it was going to be too hard to deal with. I got another attorney that is taking the case, and he's in this mode of trying to settle it right now because it's going to be, you know, he's got like a single office. He doesn't have a lot of resources. The city of Fresno was just going to bury him in appeals and motions to dismiss, and he's going to be hard-pressed to continue this case. And my point is that we need to pursue this case because in discovery we could try to drill into this gang task force that the police has. That's basically a death squad targeting young Latino men. There's been just multiple cases of young men being shot by the police for no good reason at all, other than the fact that they want to assassinate them. So my desire is to see this go to trial and to call the police out on it. But the difficultness of it is that it's really hard for attorneys, even if they're good people, to stick with it and see it through to the end because of certain dynamics that take place in these cases, like having to come up with the resources to confront the city who has deep pockets. For example, when the city of Fresno was defending Jerry Dyer, who's the police chief in a recent case, they spent, it was $830,000 on a top L.A. lawyer come up and argue this case. And Dyer had done some just incredibly egregious things, and they didn't even win, but they were able to beat back the legal challenge by just throwing, you know, these high-priced lawyers,
you know,
that can bury you in paperwork.
Yeah, no, I mean, that is always a problem. I mean, this is the problem with not quite the same thing, but the Santa Cruz 11, who are facing four, the final four, as I call them, are coming up for trial in September and coming up for a hearing on August 16th. I don't know, it's a readiness hearing or a status hearing. You know, their crime is being inside a vacant bank building, Wells Fargo owned or leased bank building, which in the midst of the Wells Fargo plunder scandal, foreclosure scandal, which is still going on, you know, I mean, there's no real, there's been some legislative protection, I guess, at the state level, but not much. And, you know, what we had this, you know, long, drawn-out proceedings. I was part of that whole thing for a long time. They'd, you know, I was also arrested, or I was charged. They didn't quite get to arrest me because I beat them down to the, you know, the clerks. but just barely. I mean, I was. They were. They got Becky Johnson and others at her house, handcuffed her, took her out, you know, burning her toast, leaving her pancakes, whatever, burning on the stove, and you know. So, it seems to me that if you try to respond in their terms with their legal bullshit, you're going to be snowed. I mean, you have to some extent. But, you know, this is Keith McHenry has suggested in the Santa Cruz 11 case. I was going to read something from him tonight. I don't think I have time. Co-founder of Food Not Bombs, that what you need to do is return to the basic issue. And I guess in the case of Latinos, it's getting shot in the back, you know, or it's death squads. You need masses of people to engage in direct action protests around this issue. And that's something they can't really effectively deal with. I guess I can shoot more people in the back. I mean, I suppose that's the one way to go. Or, you know, publish, you know, their daughter's whereabouts and the way they look and, you know, maps to their house and all that stuff. That's never happened to me yet, although, you know, I'm no doubt down the road somewhere. But it's still, I know you've tried some direct actions, you've done some protests, but you have so many connections with different organizations who I think would be... Are they not sympathetic to justice against this dire character? this police chief?
Well, you know, the one group that really is in their face is the Brown Berets here in Fresno. They have pretty regular demonstrations in front of the police department. They take out megaphones. You know, they're calling on Dyer's either resignation or calling on City Hall to fire him. And they're pretty clear in their demands. If they had more of a following, they would be more of a threat. But as it is, you know, they get out 20, 30, 40 people at a demonstration. It only goes so far. I mean, you've got to have a lot of different tools in your toolbox in order to confront power and change things. I'm not saying that a legal approach is the only way to go.
No, I'm not saying you shouldn't use it either. I mean, I agree with you there.
It's one of the tools we have that we should use, and certainly sometimes civil disobedience is a great tool. Demonstrations
are another one. Was there much response in Fresno to the Trayvon Martin verdict, the Zimmerman verdict?
Yeah. There was, for a week or so, there were events every night. Some of them quite large. Hundreds of people would get together and there'd be candlelight vigils. There would be what they call a light brigade, where they have these lights that they put up over the freeways, justice for Trayvon. There were marches, lots of things. That's pretty much slowed down now. I just saw the Fruitvale Station movie last Sunday about Oscar Grant. That was a really good movie. I enjoyed watching that.
I haven't seen it yet, but I hear it's good.
Yeah, you'll feel like you're right there with them, and it's just like so moving. You know, it'll make you want to cry to see what happened. The really odd thing, Robert, about my experience in watching that is I went with some friends, and two of the friends, both of them are white, independently of each other after the movie when I talked to them, they both said how hard it is for the police to deal with these kinds of situations, that we have to understand the pressures that they're under. And to me, I just was like, I couldn't hardly believe that people would say that, because the police in that case completely misevaluated the situation. They escalated the tension and the violence, and then they shot him. Yeah.
They executed him, is what they did. I mean, that's my view. This bullshit about the taser thing is just, you know, beyond. Yeah, I was following it at the time. The guy, Marzulli, who killed Oscar Grant 3 or 4 years ago on the New Year's Eve, Fruitvale Station, I guess it was, right? That's where it happened. You know,
yeah.
He claimed he was trying to taser him, but a taser is a much different weapon than a gun. And it's, I suppose it's conceivable, but it's hard to imagine, and it just didn't make any. Anyway,
Robert, if it was you, I mean, to put it in our terms, if you didn't know the difference between a microphone and a headphone, that's kind of the difference between a taser and a revolver. That's their business. That's what they do. They use these weapons. You know, they practice with them all the time, and they didn't know the difference. It's ludicrous.
Well, it's also you handle it differently. It's differently shaped. It's differently sized. I don't know if it's worth going into, because I'm more interested in Fresno, and we've got about 5 minutes left in this, and you probably got to go too. I know.
Well, what do you really want to know?
I know what I've been trying to coax you to do, and you've told me you're interested in doing, is to do a video of these encampments, maybe before and after they're destroyed. I was hoping to get Brent Adams to go out and, because he does good video work. I think you may have looked at the Sanctuary Campground video that I sent you. Maybe you didn't, I don't know, but he's put that online, and he's also a great maker of posters and so forth. He does great graphics, and he's been really working really hard on the Sanctuary Campground issue here. I don't agree with his strategy, and I don't think it's likely to be successful, but I certainly wish him well with it. But you have been I don't know how successful you've been. You know, they're tearing down the camps anyway. But, you know, you've been able to mobilize, you and others, some of the minimal services that we still can't get for people in Santa Cruz, even though, you know, I mean, we're obviously a smaller community, but, you know, we're per capita probably much wealthier than Fresno.
That's true.
You know, we can't get, you know, I mean, it's easier in a larger community to get people who are more sympathetic on the left, or on the right, for that matter, I would imagine. You know, but I'd like to see you go out. You know, I mean, how's that possibility, is that video project coming? You said you would take people on a video, on a tour of campgrounds, although you never made a video of it, and I was suggesting, gee, make a video of it. That would be great. We can post it, and we can see how people are actually living and struggling on the day-to-day basis in Fresno, in, you know, with the grit and the grime, and also the success, in the sense that, yeah, I can go to the bathroom, yeah, I can keep my property safe, so forth.
We will do that before this demolition happens, and maybe we'll do an after version too. I just wish we had the skill to do a kind of presentation of this as skillfully as they did Fruitvale Station, because that, if you can do something like that, it really will reach a lot more people. A short documentary of me yakking is not likely to be all that interesting, but we'll do the best we can.
Yeah, well, I remember you and others in Simone were responsible for a $2.3 million success last time. So,
yeah, that's not bad.
Not bad at all. Talking with Mike Rhodes of Fresno, you can find his long series of archives on the Community Homeless Alliance website, where you've written dozens of articles that are archived there on that subject.
Probably hundreds, yeah. And people should go to FresnoAlliance.com. And then I think there's a tab on there for homelessness, and a whole bunch of articles will come up from that.
Well, that's great. Anything you want to conclude with? Anything we haven't covered? Anything coming up that you want to mention?
Well, just briefly, one of the interesting things here is that the city of Fresno, the city manager, Bruce Rudd, has said that... publicly to the Fresno Bee, and they printed it, that the city had made an agreement with homeless advocates to run and operate the encampments in downtown Fresno, and that we failed in delivering what we said we would do to keep them safe and clean and not turning into a place where crime takes place. So, and then he uses that to beat us over the head with, say that, you know, we didn't do what we said we were going to do. The interesting thing here is that there was never such an agreement.
They're lying? Is that what you're saying, Mike?
Oh, you're shocked, aren't you?
I am. How can you... Fresno Bee is a... And the city manager, why, he's probably the highest paid official in the city. Maybe not.
He's one of them. He's not the highest. He gets, you know, probably close to $200,000.
I mean, would they risk their reputations in suggesting that...
I asked George Hostetter, who's the Fresno Bee reporter, about it. I said, look, that never happened. Would you ask Bruce, you know, what group he's referring to? And he got back to me the next day and said, Bruce won't tell me who the agreement was with.
Well, it's classified, Michael. You don't seem to understand that, you know, these are issues that, you know, you have to talk to either Bradley Manning or Edward Snowden, maybe Julian Assange, to get the facts on, you know. So.
Well, maybe they'll put me in the same position that Julian Assange and other people are in for trying to find out what's really going on in our government.
Well, look at the positive side. I mean, after all, Bradley Manning is only facing 136 years, isn't it, in prison, as distinguished from a possible death penalty. So, you know, cheer up. Things are okay.
Well, it's going to be very bad here, Robert, in the next couple of weeks. These demolitions are going to take place. People's lives are going to be disrupted. People are probably going to die as a result of that. And then you have city officials lying. You have them trying to discredit us, and you have people attacking me, just like, I can't keep up with it. So we're going to try to do the best we can. It sounds like, from what I've heard just the last couple of days, there seem to be people lining up that are willing to do something. That we don't know exactly what we're going to do to respond to this, but people are starting to ask me, how can I help? And so that's a good thing. And as we develop a strategy, I'll let you know.
Yeah. I mean, as I say when, you know, usually at the end of each show, you know, keep your video cameras, camcorders, and, you know, phone cameras available at all times, because you never know what you're going to see on the streets, and it could be, you know, the case that suddenly exposes to the broader community the kind of outrages that you know occur every day, but you can't document so easily.
That reminds me, I got to take a video camera over to William and Lori so they could video the next time Officer Lee comes by.
Oh, well, I would like to have perhaps an autographed picture of Officer Lee, if he doesn't mind. I could pass it around.